From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Over 1 million people are without power in Louisiana today after Hurricane Ida came ashore and charged through the state. Here's how Governor John Bel Edwards described the situation this morning.
The storm surge, the rain, the wind, all had devastating impacts across southeast Louisiana. Virtually no one has electricity in this part of our state right now. We have water systems that are out. We have tremendous damage to homes and to businesses.
At least one person was killed in the storm, which made landfall yesterday as a powerful Category 4 hurricane, 16 years to the day since Hurricane Katrina devastated the region. Fortunately, the levees that protect New Orleans appear to have held this time, but the damage is still extensive. Pete Dufresne is president of the St. James Parish just west of New Orleans, and he joins us now on a Skype line. Mr. Dufresne, first of all, thank you for making time for us today on what must be a very busy day. What sort of damage did you wake up to?
Yes, thank you for having us. Well, this morning we were awakened to widespread power outages across our parish, significant wind damages. We're not only seeing structural damages, but most significantly, you know, we have trees and power lines down across the parishes. Many of our roads remain impassable and are not safe for travel at this time. We have our operations crews and 911 responders out and about cutting and pushing debris from the roadways so we can make our highways passable again for our residents. The ones who have evacuated, you know, we want to get them back as soon as we can, but not too early. You know, we don't want them to come back too quick until we have time to get our infrastructure back in order.
What about flooding, and how are the levees in your area holding up?
Well, the levees in our area held up well. We just did some extensive repairs on a major levee we had on the west bank. The levee held up fine. And on the east bank, we don't have levee protection as of yet. We're still waiting on that from the risk reduction system that the Corps of Engineers currently has underway.
Give me a sense of what it's going to take to get this power back on to the residents of your parish and how long you might be prepared to hold out without it.
We had the power grid has been impacted from New Orleans all the way through Baton Rouge and north of us and all the way south of us through the Gulf to the Gulf of Mexico. So major outages is expected for weeks to come.
And tell me about your concerns, because I know it is very, very hot in the New Orleans area right now, and people, I mean, it could be dangerous, sir.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm mostly concerned about our elderly, our residents who's most vulnerable. You know, we have our senior centers, our old folks home, and we have a lot of residents who depend on dialysis and oxygen and things of that nature. And that's my biggest concerns, is the most vulnerable.
Do you have running water?
We have a very, very minimal supply of running water right now. Our water distribution system right now is currently running maybe 25%, which is not adequate at all. Should we have one structure fire, we're not going to be able to put it out.
I spoke with a doctor earlier today who's operating the Children's Hospital in New Orleans on a generator. What is the situation with hospitals in your parish, and what are you doing to make sure that they can stay open and that those patients are safe?
Our hospital right now is currently on a generator as well. They're doing the best they can with what they have. They're going to continue operating. Our biggest concern right now is for our residents to stay home, to try to avoid navigating themselves throughout the community. We want them to assess their own homes and properties and help us find the water leaks from that was caused by uprooted trees that has broken the water mains and things of that nature. So the quicker that we can identify these water leaks and we can have them repaired, we can get our water distribution system back operational.
Oh, well, to that point, I know your parish also includes a lot of industrial facilities, chemical plants. What impact did the storm have on those, and is there a risk of pollution or any exposure to those chemicals?
Absolutely no risk of pollution or exposure that I'm aware of. I have been in communication with many of our industry partners. Thank God we have our industry here in St. James Parish. They have been reaching out, and they have been just a tremendous source of resources that our residents need, such as water, food, just different supplies. We have they're doing the best they can to gather some tarps for to help our residents cover the roofs. Just been a tremendous asset here in St. James Parish.
All right. We've been speaking with Pete Dufresne, president of the St. James Parish in Louisiana. Sir, thank you very much for your time, and we wish you continued good luck as you try to recover from this storm. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
This week, some of the nation's most restrictive provisions on abortion are set to take effect in Texas. The law would ban abortions when a fetal heartbeat can be detected, and that can come even before a woman knows she's pregnant. Opponents of abortion rights are cheering an appeals court decision this weekend that let the new law go forward. Others are warning of chaos for healthcare providers in the state. Dr. G. Seeley Massengill is one of them. He's obstetrician, gynecologist, and chief medical officer at Planned Parenthood in Greater Texas. Dr. Massengill, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Now, your group is challenging this law. If it actually takes effect on Wednesday, what will it mean for women in your clinic who may have scheduled abortions, and what will it mean for you?
Well, we have been planning for it to go into effect. As of Wednesday morning, women will face the daunting prospect of not only having one ultrasound, but probably having two ultrasounds. Texas is one of the states that requires a 24-hour waiting period. Women who are going to be required to, come in, get an ultrasound, schedule the next appointment, come back and have another ultrasound. If that ultrasound shows a detectable motion in the fetal chest, we will unfortunately not be able to proceed with their procedure. And as you said in the introduction, most of these women will barely know they're pregnant. They will have missed a period by a week or two. And as they're already required to travel, usually vast distances to get to us because we're a big state and we only have abortion services in four locations, it's a problem. It's a real problem.
And let me ask you about this provision of this detectable motion. I guess that some would liken that to a heartbeat. If there's the detection of that, then in those cases, just for me to understand it here, those abortions under this law would not be allowed, even though that can happen very early in a pregnancy?
Yes, they would not be allowed. That's the way our legal team reads the statute, and we intend to comply with the statute completely. Despite our belief, it is absolutely unconstitutional.
You're right, and the legal language is complicated here. One provision, as I understand it, could spark what some worry could be bounty hunters there. That is, regular people who may not necessarily be involved in the medical issue here have an incentive. Is that right in this language to report doctors, people are driving women, even insurance companies involved in this?
Yes. Any human being, and not just Texans, can file these lawsuits in any venue in Texas they wish to file. They can find some judge in rural Texas someplace who wants to make a name for themselves and just accept all kinds of crazy, baseless claims, which will then have to be defended. So it's tragic.
Doctor, finally, can I ask you about your conversations with your patients then? How is that going? Are some of your patients thinking of leaving the state of Texas?
We, thankfully, so far, we have not had to tell anybody they can't be scheduled that I've seen for the evaluation process, that they couldn't be scheduled before Wednesday. So far, everybody I've actually talked to, we've been able to schedule their procedure before the law takes effect. On Wednesday, okay, when we start having conversations with people who are, we will be telling them, you cannot have an abortion. And I suspect that much like the last week and a half, where many people were like, what are you talking about? What happened on September the 1st? I suspect there'll be a lot of people who will be quite upset. We'll be telling them that you need to leave the state. Now, again, here in Dallas-Fort Worth, which is where I live and work, the Oklahoma you know, Oklahoma City, where there's a provision will be available, is only a 3-hour drive. And you can say, well, that's a long time. But, you know, in Texas, it's only a 3-hour drive, right? And a lot of Texans, we don't think much of a 3-hour drive. So,
yeah, I
but yeah, it's going to be an issue. New Mexico and Oklahoma are bracing for more work.
That is Dr. G. Seeley Massengill, obstetrician, gynecologist, and chief medical officer of Planned Parenthood of Greater Texas. Doctor, thanks for the time.
My pleasure.
In recent days, the Biden administration has launched several counterattacks against ISIS-K. The group claimed responsibility for last week's suicide bombing at the Kabul airport that killed 13 U.S. service members and well over 100 civilians. Yesterday, a U.S. drone strike in Kabul killed a suspected suicide bomber whom the U.S. military said posed an imminent threat to Americans evacuating the airport. The drone also reportedly killed a number of civilians. Here is Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby this morning.
We've used the word dynamic a lot, and I know that sounds like Pentagon speak, but that's really the best way to describe the threats we're facing. Dynamic, moving, fluid, quick. And because that's how ISIS-K operates. And we have to try to be as quick and as nimble as they are.
Andrew Mines is with George Washington University's program on extremism. He's been tracking ISIS-K for years, and he joins us now. Andrew, welcome. Good to speak with you.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
And what do you make of the U.S. military's strikes in recent days against ISIS-K? Do you think they were effective?
Well, one of the things we've seen over time is that this group's really resilient and is able to kind of both bounce back and survive periods of intense counterterrorism and counterinsurgency campaigns. And so I think we really need to look past this period and recognize that in the long term, this group is able to survive these kind of strikes.
I think we also need to look back. The group was founded by former members of the Pakistani Taliban, the Afghan Taliban, and others. What is their primary motivation in Afghanistan? What are they trying to achieve?
Their primary motivation is to establish basically what ISIS did in Iraq and Syria in Afghanistan. Used to be Afghanistan and Pakistan, but now it's solely focused on Afghanistan. That means implementing the same version of the Sharia that ISIS did in Iraq and Syria, implementing the same kind of strategy of insurgency in the region too.
And they are enemies of the Taliban, correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Can you explain that?
Yeah, sure. So ISK sees the Afghan Taliban as its strategic rivals. The main way that that kind of plays out is that the Taliban are focused on a political entity, an emirate, only within the national confines of Afghanistan, within the borders of Afghanistan. ISIS and ISK do not recognize those boundaries. They view them as heretical, as kind of just, you know, basically implementing of the U.S.-led international world order, and contrary to their efforts to really establish a global caliphate. They also view the Afghan Taliban as not implementing the strictest version of the Sharia that they tried to implement. And so they view them as their strategic rivals when they try to kind of seize the legacy of the broader jihadist movement in Afghanistan that's been around for decades.
And so we are now about 24 hours from the end of the U.S. mission in Afghanistan. And once the military leaves, do you think the Taliban will be able to keep ISIS-K in check?
It's a difficult question. Certainly the last week and the last few days has kind of put a few holes in the Taliban's kind of efforts to kind of promote itself as the guarantor of security in Afghanistan.
So you expect a pretty serious conflict between those two groups in the months and years ahead?
Absolutely. This group tries to implement a lot of the same things that the group in Iraq and Syria did. And if we look back to how that group, when it was basically declared down and out in 2009, what they were saying at that time is that the one who can win this war is the one who can best prepare for the period when the occupiers, the Americans, are gone. And so they have ambitions well beyond our withdrawal, and we need to take that very seriously.
To that point, I'm thinking about the attack on Thursday at the airport and wondering if that somehow boosts their stature among other terrorist groups in the region and even maybe could elevate their ability to recruit more fighters, because now all of a sudden they're the group in town that everybody's talking about.
Absolutely. Part of it is kind of a messaging campaign. It's awful violence. It's spectacular violence, but it's messaging their resolve and signaling to other groups and other individuals in the region that they are the only viable alternative and the only viable jihadist group in the region, too. They paint the Taliban as collaborators with the West, right? They paint them as failed collaborators with the West. They can't even provide security to the Afghan people. And so that's incredibly damaging to the Taliban's reputation. And it serves for ISK to add more recruits into their ranks on top of the thousands they already got.
Just a week ago, we weren't even really talking about ISIS. We were talking about Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
And I just wonder if you think that to some extent, like, this took people by surprise.
I think it definitely took people who haven't been following this closely for the last, I don't know, 5-6 years that the group's been around by surprise. But we've been tracking this group for years, and we've dropped the largest non-nuclear weapon, the only time we've ever done this, on this group, and they've been able to survive. They've been able to reconstitute. And so it is that ability, that strategic plan, and how much they've learned from Iraq and Syria, and their ability to kind of implement that and oversee these periods of relative decline and hang in for the long term. They have the leadership, they have the vision, they have the resources to pursue this next period of a war against the Afghan Taliban. And I think people are just starting to wake up to that. And the scary thing is that when these groups move, they're always kind of doing these things in the background, politicking with local tribes, with other groups. It's always going on in the background. In some ways, like, these spectacular attacks distract from that. And then when they finally do seize control of territory, implement things that we look at as just awful and just violent and horrific against civilian populations, it always, to us, happens so quickly, and we're always very surprised by it. But it's years of planning. It's years of kind of backstage working on top of the attacks that leads to it.
Andrew Mines is with George Washington University's program on extremism. He's been tracking the group ISIS-K for years now. Andrew, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Many of the people evacuated from Afghanistan have been sent to a third country as they await vetting from the U.S. government. It can be a lengthy and harrowing process. Kinan Al-Rifai knows it well. She came to the U.S. in 2014 as one of more than 6.5 million people forced to flee Syria in the decade since the start of that country's civil war. She was separated from her children for 2 years as she waited for their applications to be approved. Her husband's paperwork took several more years. Alexis Marshall of member station WPLN spoke with Al-Rifai about the challenges and opportunities of rebuilding a life for her family in Middle Tennessee.
This is called kebab hindi. That's what we call it. It's onion, tomato, and then we make like meat fingers, and then we put it in the oven.
Is this the same type of meal that you would have been cooking, like, back home in Damascus?
Yeah, sure. Exactly the same thing.
Syria meant a lot for me. I mean, I love it to the death. I had a ton of friends in there, my whole entire, you know, from the school to the university to, I used to be in a charity in the masjid for a long time, to the work. So I had a ton of friends in there that I had my most adorable memories with them. So I love Damascus, and I really spent a lot of time after I left it just imagining going back to there. However, now you feel like things are getting more and more complicated, and you feel like Syria is really getting worse and worse. It's just the idea of going back in there is kind of like vanishing day by day. Sometimes I just feel like, is my kids going to even visit Syria or Damascus someday? Are they going to see where they were born? Raising the kids in a place that is different culture, different religions, different type of thinking, different system, everything is different, is very hard for us. For kids, it's always, they adjust to whatever. And we don't mind, but we still want them to keep their culture. We still want them to keep their language. I fight with my daughter the whole day, all day, to speak Arabic. As a mom who lost her kids for a while and stayed in a place that she was forced to not see them, I have this spot in my heart that from the time they got back to me, I always feel like I don't want to think that I'm going to lose them again. Here's my husband.
Hi.
Salim, arrib salim. Ma tsafih ba salim yani.
How's your day been?
I'm tired.
Yeah.
Let me just check very quickly on the food and if it's ready.
We had, tragedy, stories about us, about our family, about our houses, which we lost. We lost the money also. We lost houses. I lost my business also there, So we don't look back. We look forward, to build again now.
Rebuild.
Our life.
Yeah. It's just for us... good feeling that we were able to rebuild. If you tell me that you will be in 10 years, you will be in America, you will be a citizen, you will have a life in there, and you will speak the language, you will teach in there, and I would say, are you kidding me? I will never be able to do that. If you tell me that in the future you will leave your kids for 2 years for any reason, I would say it's not me. That's not the person you're talking about. I really need to share with people that first immigrants are not bad people. They're just, the only thing is that they found refuge in this country and they were able to thrive again, but they needed time.
The voices of Kinan Al-Rifai and her husband, Ziyad Al-Dairi, speaking with WPLN's Alexis Marshall. You're listening to Here and Now.
NPR's Planet Money Summer School is in session. This season is all about investing. Like, is it better to buy a lot of one stock or a little bit of a lot of stocks? What are bonds? Is it ever too late to start investing? New classes every Wednesday till Labor Day in the Planet Money podcast feed.
Back to school means back to student loan issues. Nearly 43 million Americans with federal loans have had a break on their payments under special rules that began with a pandemic last March. But in 5 months, it's set to expire. Let's bring in Jill Schlesinger, business analyst at CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
Now, the White House has just extended this so-called forbearance on student loan payments until the end of January 2022. This sounds like it could be the last extension, yeah?
Absolutely. In fact, federal government officials were clear that this is the final time that they are going to put student loan payments on pause. Now, remember, this began back in the spring of 2020 amid COVID. It was really a chance to let student borrowers breathe a bit, and it has been extended a couple times, but this is it. This is the last time that they say they're going to extend it. So if you've got an outstanding balance, you're going to continue to see a suspension of your payments. There's still 0% interest on until January 31st, and the government says it will halt collections on defaulted loans until that time as well.
Okay, so help me understand this a little bit more. A lot of college students and parents have continuing angst about money and loans, and I'm raising my own hand high here. If I'm a student and I've had these payments paused during the emergency, what does this mean for me now if I'm now getting ready for January?
Well, of course, the first thing you have to do is go check in on your loans, the balances, the interest rate that will kick into effect. But the reality is, for most borrowers, this means just adding in this forbearance time, the period that you haven't had to pay, and it just gets tacked on to the end of the loan. And even if you have an income-driven repayment plan, the COVID suspension will not delay your progress. So it's really just sort of pushing out what the time horizon is for paying off your loans.
Okay, now... for the rest of us, income-driven repayment plan?
Well, this is an interesting plan. It's only for government loans, and it basically allows people who have borrowed money say, wait, I'm not making as much money as I thought I was going to make. These loan payments are onerous, and you can say to the government, I want to make my loan into a plan that is based on the amount of money I earn. Now, the problem with income-based repayment plans is they can last a lot longer than that 10 years you may have thought, but it gives you breathing room until you start making more money.
I see. Okay. Okay. But that should be an option for students who are thinking about, okay, I got to scramble. This is one choice they could pursue. Yeah.
Absolutely. And again, only for government loans. So if you have a private loan, the things we're talking about do not apply to you.
Yeah. Okay. And finally, the government now says, right, this payment relief is going to end in a few months, just as the economy might be going south again with this Delta variant. So what could this mean? Could this mean that some students are going to have to drop out?
You know, I hope not. I think that that's one of the biggest problems that we face with student loan borrowers. We really want to make sure that people graduate with a degree, because only with that degree, you don't get any partial credit for 3 or 4 years or one of the 2-year community college. You need to complete your degree. And just know, putting your head down and finishing that degree amounts to earnings of about $1 million more over the life of your career than those who don't have that college degree. So it is worth it.
Yeah, we have heard about this college wage premium. That's quite a number. And that is Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. Jill, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
We're tracking Tropical Storm Ida and its path of destruction through Louisiana and Mississippi today. The storm came ashore south of New Orleans yesterday as a Category 4 hurricane, pummeling the region with extreme winds, flash flooding, and a dangerous storm surge. FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell told ABC's Good Morning America that the full extent of the damage is still unknown.
You know, unfortunately, I think we're going to see more damage than what we probably initially projected. Not only was this a Category 4 storm, but it stayed a Category 4 storm for hours over southern parts of Louisiana. Having those high winds for several hours, the storm surge for several hours, as well as the intense rainfall. You know, I think as we get up this morning, we're hearing reports, but we're going to see even more destruction. This is going to be a really long recovery.
Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards had warned the storm would be the most severe test of New Orleans' flood control system since Hurricane Katrina made landfall exactly 16 years ago. With the levees holding for now, Governor Edwards said rescue and recovery efforts are underway.
Virtually no one has electricity in this part of our state right now. We have water systems that are out. We have tremendous damage to homes and to businesses. We know that individuals are out there waiting to be rescued because their homes are not habitable. Many places we have floodwaters that are encroaching upon those homes. Please know that we have thousands of people out right now with high water vehicles and boats who are doing search and rescue.
This storm intensified quickly, and it is a reminder of the power of climate change to turbocharge hurricanes. Warmer air holds more water, and scientists have long warned that climate change will create more intense storms. We're also seeing other significant signs of change around the world. This month, scientists studying one of the biggest ice sheets on the globe made a shocking observation. For the first time in recorded history, rain fell on the highest point in Greenland. And that discovery came at the same time policymakers are grappling with the UN's recent landmark report on climate change, which said that it is accelerating and driving the increase in extreme weather. Josh Willis is lead scientist with NASA's Oceans Melting Greenland mission. He's been spending the summer flying around that ice sheet there, and he joins us now to tell us what he has been seeing. Josh, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks so much for having me.
Can we start with this news about the rain in Greenland falling? Because it really stopped me in my tracks. How did the news hit you?
Well, Peter, exactly the same way. I was really stunned to hear that there was actually rain. We've been flying over the Greenland ice sheet during our mission this year, and it's almost 10,000 feet. And in fact, at summit, it is 10,000 feet. And that's supposed to be the land of snow. Mm.
No matter where you are, I mean,
right.
10,000 feet is a tremendous amount of elevation, right? So, look, you've been making these flights. You know what's happening on Greenland. Most of us do not. Tell me what you saw when you flew over the ice sheet.
Well, in fact, actually, shortly after that huge melt event, we flew from the east side of Greenland over to the west side, And a lot of times there's clouds, of course, over the ice sheet, so you can't always see what's going on down there. But the other day it was perfectly clear, and we flew over a huge area of melt. There were giant lakes, hundreds of tiny rivers carrying this water around. And our captain of the airplane, who's been flying over Greenland for a quarter of a century, remarked he'd never seen anything this big, this high on the plateau, this late in the year.
So this is rare and concerning.
Absolutely. You know, there's records of melt at the summit, and it's an extremely rare kind of thing. Normally, it's once every 100 years or so, but actually, there's been 3 episodes in the last 2 decades. So it's becoming more frequent, and it's going to continue to do that as the planet keeps heating up.
We're going to link people to pictures of your flight. You can see the blue lakes that you're talking about on the ice sheet. It looks beautiful, but it's not. And it's also not an isolated event, as you just said. Danish researchers have estimated that enough ice melted in July on that ice sheet to cover all of Florida in 2 inches of water, which sounds scary. But could you put that magnitude of the melting into perspective for us so that we can better understand what's going on?
Well, this is a big melt year, and in fact, there wasn't just one big melt this year, there were 2. Any way you cut it, this is going to be one for the record books. It may not be the most melt we've ever seen, but it'll be in the top 10, probably the top 5, and almost all the others are within the last decade. So this is something that we're beginning to see more and more, and in fact, Greenland's melted enough in the last 15 years or so, 5 trillion tons of ice. And that's enough to raise global sea levels by almost an inch, a big fraction of an inch. So what's happening on this island is really affecting the entire planet.
Greenland is huge. It's like 3 times the size of Texas, right?
That's right. It's just a reminder just how much ice there is. You know, it's 10,000 feet thick in some places. That's 2 miles.
Wow.
And it affects the whole planet's climate, and it affects sea level all over the world.
Help me understand how important the ice sheet is to the rest of the world.
Well, of course, the ice that's in Greenland, the water that's in Greenland, it doesn't stay in Greenland. Ice lost there spreads sea level rise across the entire planet. So whether you live in Australia or South America, you feel it all over the world. That's a really huge deal. If you think about it, the oceans cover 2/3 of the planet's surface, and we're literally raising that surface by an inch or so every decade or two. That means we're literally reshaping our entire planet.
The IPCC report says that over the next 2 decades, the planet will heat up by at least 1.5 degrees Celsius compared to the late 19th century levels. So if that is the future that we're looking at here, what does Greenland look like in 20 years?
It's going to keep melting, and it's going to melt at a faster and faster rate. And what we've found with our experiment in oceans melting Greenland is that it's not just the warming atmosphere that's driving ice loss in Greenland. It's the warming oceans, too. And if the oceans are eating away at Greenland's ice from the edges, then we actually have a lot more to worry about in terms of sea level rise and Greenland ice loss than we thought before. And every time we make a new discovery, we raise the bar on how much sea level rise we're expecting.
Let me ask you this. You make a lot of trips there, and this is not a scientific question. But when you see Greenland melting, does it make you a little sick?
Well, it's shocking to realize the footprint that humans have on our planet. When you get in an airplane and you fly for 2 hours and there's 2 miles of ice underneath you the whole time, you think about that, the fact that we're causing that to melt. It's disappearing right in front of us. You know, and it's not way out in the future. It's not next decade or later this century. It's right now, and it's already started happening.
Is there a tipping point? In other words, we reach a level of melt that we just can't return from, or the level of consequence will be just so much greater that we can't escape?
There are almost certainly tipping points in the climate. And the big problem is we don't know where they are. So we're pushing our climate towards the edge of a cliff, but we can't see how close we are to the edge. And these tripwires, like runaway ice melt, are things that we are pretty sure exist, but we just don't know when we're going to hit them. That's the scariest part.
Josh Willis is lead scientist with NASA's Oceans Melting Greenland mission. As I said, we'll post the pictures from his flights over the ice sheet in Greenland at hereandnow.org. Josh, thank you very much for your insights and spending some time with us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
It has been 50 years since a group of anti-war activists conducted a raid on an FBI office in Pennsylvania. They exposed widespread government surveillance of Americans. The operation, called COINTELPRO, targeted African-American leaders, among others. And this week, some members of that break-in team are returning to the scene of their crime to install a historical marker. Kenny Cooper of member station WHYY reports.
They were tumultuous times as the 1960s became the 1970s. The Civil Rights Movement, the Vietnam War, protests and peace marches, resistance from activists meeting resistance from law enforcement and government all across the country. In Philadelphia, eight people calling themselves the Citizens Commission to Investigate the FBI pulled off a risky break-in, stealing more than 1,000 documents from a bureau office and media about 12 miles outside of the city. Some of those papers revealed abuses of power at the nation's highest levels. Bonnie Raines, now 79, was one of those activists.
50 years ago, we were criminals, and now we're heroes.
Raines first immersed herself in the civil rights and anti-war movement down south. That's also where she met her husband, John, a one-time Temple University religion professor who died in 2017. John Raines was part of the Freedom Rides before the couple moved north to Philadelphia, to join the many others who had coalesced to disrupt the draft and the war. Keith Forsyth, now 71, dropped out of Wooster College in Ohio and hitchhiked to Philly in 1970 for basically the same reason.
Once I realized the lies that were being told about that war and how evil it actually was, it sort of opened me up to questioning a lot of other stuff.
Eventually, they met the man who would mastermind the media FBI heist, William Bill Davidon, a physics and mathematics professor at Haverford College.
Bill seemed like one of the few people that I knew, you know, who really had the chops to organize and lead something like this successfully.
They began to case the FBI's media office in a building that also housed apartments and monitor the patterns of the people around it. But by February 1971, they still needed to get inside and up to the second floor. Bonnie Raines got in by impersonating a Swarthmore College student interested in FBI opportunities for women.
And I was 29 at the time, but everybody said that I still looked kind of like a kid. So I tried to disguise my appearance as much as I could. I put my hair, long hair, up inside of a winter hat, and I wore glasses that I didn't ordinarily wear, and tried to look like a college student.
Raines got a mental snapshot of the office, so they set the date strategically, March 8th, 1971. When people everywhere will be watching the fight of the century, Muhammad Ali versus Joe Frazier. Working around some obstacles, the 21-year-old Forsyth picked the lock, broke a deadbolt, and got the door open, all without being heard by the building manager, who happened to live right downstairs.
The manager was indeed listening to the fight on the radio because I could hear it through the floor. That provided some very welcome distraction.
The group grabbed as many files as they could and drove north to a Quaker farm in Pottstown.
We sent them to three newspapers, three journalists at the Washington Post, the New York Times, and the Los Angeles Times. And we also sent copies of the documents to two members of Congress.
But the two lawmakers sent their copies to the FBI, as did the LA Times and the New York Times. Enter Betty Metzger, a reporter for the Washington Post, whom Bonnie and John Raines had known from her days working for the old Philadelphia Bulletin in the 1960s.
The first file was the one that became sort of emblematic of the Berger's file, a document that advised agents and informers to make people paranoid.
There were files, for example, that revealed the FBI had hired informants to listen in on phone calls at Swarthmore College and had surveilled every black student on campus. The Nixon administration pressured Washington Post publisher Catherine Graham and editor Ben Bradley, Metzger says, but ultimately the Post decided to publish.
But I like to think that because of the very difficult time that she had back in March, it was an easier thing for her to say yes to running the Pentagon Papers.
In 1975, the FBI came under fire by Congress during hearings that revealed illegal operations by intelligence agencies. The FBI has systematically spied on, sought to discredit, and at certain points neutralized members of the civil rights, feminists, environmentalists, Puerto Rican independence, and communist movements.
Prior to the burglary, there was no official oversight of intelligence agencies, which made it possible for secrecy and crimes to occur.
Once their job was done, the burglars pledged a vow of secrecy until the statute of limitations for burglary ran out. Their involvement stayed more or less secret until the 1980s. A book by Metzger and a Netflix documentary followed as the decades passed. Now their actions will be commemorated with a historical marker, a screening of the documentary, and a panel discussion featuring the activists, Metzger, a former FBI agent, and a civil rights attorney. For Here and Now, I'm Kenny Cooper.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Scott Tong.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.